Well, we've all heard the passage now, haven't we? I've got a tough gig this morning. Two passages. The first one, Jesus calls a desperate woman a dog. The second one, well, Paul covered the feeding of the 5,000 a couple of weeks back. So this is just more of the same, isn't it? Only, as James put it when we were chatting about it, 20% less impressive. So that's two awkward conundrums to get to the bottom of. Thanks, Jez and Lee, very much. I'm only kidding. Only, in fact, both of these help us to see how Jesus is working to reorientate his disciples towards his kingdom and their purpose, and also to point us towards our purpose. So, good. So we're working our way through this section of Matthew, looking for keys of the kingdom. As Lou helpfully recapped for us last week, so far we've had understanding who Jesus is, obedience, growing in faith in Jesus, and heart knowledge, not just head knowledge. Today we'll revisit a couple of these, particularly understanding who Jesus is and growing in faith. But the key to the kingdom we're going to look at today is knowing what we are here for. For those of us who are Christians, I wonder what the funniest reaction is that you've ever had when someone has found out you're a Christian. Has anyone ever had a funny reaction to that? The most common one for me probably is polite avoidance of the subject from henceforth. Another common one is starting to apologise to me for swearing. At some points in life, I've had someone rather embarrassingly point out how good I am, although there's always a little bit of a subtext of goody two-shoes in that, so I wouldn't take that too seriously. A few times, I've had someone noticeably distance themselves from me because they're expecting me to be judgmental about their lives or their choices in ways that I never dreamt of being. And to avoid this turning into too much of a pity fest, I do have some friends that come to me sometimes for honest advice. And I wonder if that resonates with anyone else in the room. Perhaps I wonder if you could raise your hand if you've ever experienced any of these, just so I don't feel like I've just massively overshared. Good. It's not just me. It's not just that I really am a weirdo. So we do get odd reactions when people find out that we're a practicing Christian. Now, what am I getting at with all of this? The point is, people aren't expecting to find out that you're a practicing Christian these days, because practicing Christians in the UK are a cultural minority. In the 2021 census, for the first time ever, less than half the people described themselves as Christian. And a 2022 survey indicated that more like 6% of the population are practicing Christians, which they defined as attending church at least once a month and praying and reading the Bible more regularly than that. My point is not to sensationalise these figures. We are where we are. My question is more practical. How do we live in these circumstances? What is our purpose? And how does that play out in a context where we are a cultural minority? As it goes, first century Judaism, the time and place where God chose to send his son into the world, faced similar questions. Once, having been the great kingdom of David and Solomon, they had been repeatedly colonized over 700 years. First by the Assyrians, then by the Babylonians, then came the Persians, then the Greeks, and now the Romans. Some of these regimes offered more religious freedom than others, but the restoration of the kingdom of Israel that they had hoped for, that the prophets had told of, had not materialized. Now, in terms of political and military power, the Romans held the reins, but culturally speaking, the Greeks had had a lasting influence. It was Alexander the Great's mission to bring the whole world under the influence of Greek culture and religion, language, philosophy, political structure, values, and he and his successors did quite a good job. Greek cultural institutions like theatres, gymnasiums, and stadiums were found in many cities, including Jerusalem, including Sepphoris, the new capital of Galilee that was built during Jesus' early life and was only about 4 miles from Nazareth. Greek was the language of commerce, and busy trade routes between the rich Hellenized cities of the Decapolis and the sea cut straight through the towns and villages of Galilee that were Jesus' stomping ground for much of his early ministry. So, politically and militarily under the thumb of the Roman Empire, lacking any real autonomy, and culturally feeling the incursion of the sophisticated, wealthy, seductive Greek culture pressing in, how did first century Judaism react? Well, we know the book of Daniel. We've been studying that in recent months. And that book was very popular in this era. All those visions of the rise and fall of empires that held the promise that someday God would restore Israel. They expected him to crush their oppressors, restore the throne of David and the temple, and all this would happen through a son of David, the Messiah. But while they waited, different groups in Judaism responded to their circumstances in different ways. From the Gospels, as well as from the writings of the historian Josephus and other ancient documents, we know of at least four sects or movements within first century Judaism. So there were the Essenes. They had very rigid, you might even say ruthless, interpretations of the purity requirements of the law. They withdrew from society and lived in complete segregation in these caves. So exclusive was their interpretation of the law that they would not allow membership of the blind, deaf, or dumb, or lame. They weren't even allowed to be in the community. So their strategy was complete withdrawal. Then you had the Zealots, and among them the Sicarii, revolutionary groups or insurrectionists who foresaw the pagan overlords being overthrown by force. They were responsible for killings and kidnappings. And ultimately, they played a leading role in the revolt against Rome, which led to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So their reaction was to fight. Then you have the Sadducees. We don't know a whole lot about this group historically. They were mainly the priestly class associated with the temple and popular with the well-to-do people in Jerusalem. They were aristocratic and wealthy. They were not particularly suffering under Roman rule, let's just say that. They lived quite opulent lifestyles. So we might describe their response as complacency or accommodation. And then finally, the group we know most about, who we heard about Jesus interacting with just last week, probably the most numerous in Jesus' time as well, we have the Pharisees. Now, they were a conspicuous, scholarly group. They were meticulous observers of the ancestral laws, and they claimed expertise in interpreting the law of Moses. They were obsessed with purity. Why? Not for its own sake. As Tom Wright points out, their agenda was to defend the boundaries of the nation, to keep the nation pure, and to keep out any potentially damaging influences. It was like a kind of defensive nationalism. And then, of course, we have the majority of ordinary, everyday Jews getting on with their lives, trying their best to observe the faith that's been passed down to them by their parents and their community. But these different sects and movements that surrounded these first century Jews, who responded to being a cultural minority in such different ways, what do they all have in common? What do you think? They were all inward-looking. They had all developed an us and them, or an us against the world mentality. In technical terms, they remembered election, but they forgot eschatology. They knew that they were God's chosen people, but they had lost sight of why, of what they were here for. So before we turn to our passages to see how Jesus reorientates his disciples towards their purpose, I'd like us all to reflect for a moment on what we are here for. What is our purpose as Christians living in the world we live in today? You've got your pens and paper, which has been handed out to you. What I'd like you to do is to write down in a few words, a sentence at the absolute maximum, what you think we are here for. You don't need to overthink it. Just write down the first thing that comes to your mind for now, and then hold on to it, and we'll come back to it later. Okay. Hopefully most people have managed to scribble down a quick thought about what we're here for. So let's turn now to Matthew chapter 15. So Jesus' confrontation with the Pharisees that we heard about last week happened in Gennesaret in Galilee. That's on the northwest coast of the Sea of Galilee, quite near Capernaum, which You might not be able to see. It's on the northwest coast of the Sea of Galilee. We see in verse 21 that he withdrew. Perhaps he wanted to avoid further conflict. And he headed north to the region of Tyre and Sidon. You can see that, sort of those two cities above and below the label at the top of the map there. So he was outside of predominantly Jewish territory, in the region of the major Roman ports of Tyre and Sidon. This was actually the same area that Elijah withdrew to centuries earlier when he was being hunted by King Ahab, where he had fed a widow from that region. So here, a Canaanite woman approaches him. And we can see in verse 23 that her presence makes the disciples extremely uncomfortable. They beg Jesus to send her away as she won't stop hassling them. Of all the people that they've encountered whilst being with Jesus, why are they so bothered by this one? Well, firstly, she's a woman. Kenneth Bailey, an expert in Middle East and New Testament studies, points out that even today, in conservative areas of the Middle East, men and women do not talk to each other across the gender barrier. Going back 2,000 years, the place of women in society was even more marginal. Women could be respected as wives, as mothers, but that didn't mean you could trust them. An aristocratic scholar of Jerusalem in the second century called Ben Sirach wrote that if you don't like your wife, you shouldn't trust her. You should keep a record of the supplies you issue to her. She should not own any property. Women are responsible for sin coming into the world, and their spite is unbearable. A daughter is a disaster, a constant potential source of shame. He writes, "A man's spite is preferable to a woman's kindness. Women give rise to shame and reproach." Now, this wasn't everyone's view, but it was there in the culture. And we know that Jesus was radically inclusive of women. They counted predominantly and prominently amongst his immediate believers and followers. They funded his early ministry. And he deliberately shaped his teachings to communicate his message just as powerfully to women as he did to men in the imagery that he used. But his disciples had some catching up to do, as did most of the people around him, to be honest. They were children of their culture, and it had taught them to be wary. Secondly, she was a Canaanite woman. You don't need to spend long in the Old Testament to find out that the Jews and the Canaanites, they had history. It was not good history. If we think about those boundaries the Pharisees and others were trying to defend around the Jewish people, Canaanites were absolutely and undisputably out. Today, we might think of the kinds of attitudes we see circulating about immigrants, especially undocumented migrants. She was a total foreigner, fit to be reviled and insulted. Finally, she was a carer, more specifically, the mother of a demon-possessed daughter. In the disciples' anxiety, there seems to be a note of fear, as if they might catch something. It's odd, they've encountered Jesus heal demon possession before. Why is this situation any different? Maybe because she's a foreigner and a woman with a demon-possessed child. I have a good friend who's of African heritage, and when the 2014 Ebola outbreak happened in West Africa, she noticed people right here in our city start to cross the street when she walked towards them. We're not as progressive and we're not as far removed from these situations as we'd like to think we are. So what's interesting about this interaction is that there are two conversations going on at the same time between Jesus and his disciples, and between Jesus and the woman. As the expert teacher that he is, Jesus uses the same interaction to respond to both students very differently. Jesus sets the woman a series of tests. Now, these aren't the kind of tests that the Pharisees used to try and catch Jesus out. They're examples of a kind and benevolent teacher with utter belief in his student to succeed, giving her the opportunity to shine. My daughter Lizzie is going to be 7 years old tomorrow. And last weekend, we were blowing up balloons for her birthday party, and she was really eager to help. She can already blow up balloons, but she can't tie the knots yet. It's really tricky, right? So I spent quite a while teaching her how to do it. And at first, she felt really frustrated that she couldn't get the hang of it. But I knew that although it was a stretch for her, she was capable of achieving it. And I wanted to give her the opportunity to master it and feel really proud of herself, which eventually she did. This is what Jesus is doing here. So let's work through the tests one by one. Hopefully you can see that. If not, you've got it in the Bible in front of you. So have a look. So the woman approaches with the words, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me." For a Gentile woman to use the combination of the word for Lord, Kyrie here, and the relatively rare Jewish messianic title, the Son of David, is quite unusual. The plea, "Have mercy on me," that's the classic cry of a beggar. And notice that the compassion she begs for is on her herself, not her daughter. She comes as a carer at the end of her resources, enduring the terrible pain of watching her daughter suffer. She clearly knows something of Jesus, perhaps from his earlier time in Tyre and Sidon, which we read about in Mark chapter 3. She approaches him with confidence in his compassion for all, be they Jews or Gentiles, male or female. So here comes the first test. Jesus responds with silence. Is this indifference? It doesn't seem likely, given how the story goes on. Instead, to me, it looks a lot like the pretense of indifference to begin the test. From the disciples' point of view, it is an absolutely appropriate reaction. Self-respecting rabbis do not talk to women, and especially not this sort. His silence emboldens the disciples, and they beg him to send the woman away. From the woman's point of view, it provides her the opportunity to demonstrate the strength in her belief that Jesus' compassion extends to her. She passes with flying colors. She ignores the disciples' comments, and she waits on Jesus' response expectantly. The next test, Jesus verbalizes the views that his disciples no doubt held, that he was their Messiah, not hers. His power and salvation are for Israel. Remember, they were from an inward-looking moment of Jewish history, an us-and-them moment, and they had waited a long time for the wrongs done to Israel to be put right. The woman's response? She perseveres. She is not deterred. Do you know, we can't hear the tone of voice in the text, but I have a feeling that Jesus spoke gently to her here. And throughout this interaction, he was not cruel. She got it. She understood the questions he was asking, and she saw the compassion underneath them. Having already taken up the stance of a beggar, she further humbles herself before Jesus, kneeling and simply asking, "Lord, help me." The final test. Jesus replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." He again reiterates a popular view, no doubt shared by his disciples, that Israel is the rightful beneficiary of his ministry. They're the ones God is interested in. Only this time he's not so polite about it. His language is very strong. Dogs in Middle Eastern traditional culture were almost as hated as pigs. They were never pets. They were half wild, dangerous scavengers. So this would have been a common and a harsh insult, probably one quite commonly used against Gentiles at the time. The message the disciples hear is quite clear. Again, as Kenneth Bailey puts it, "I know you think Gentiles are dogs and you want me to treat them as such. But pay attention. This situation you're witnessing here, this is where your biases lead. Are you comfortable with this scene?" He exposed their prejudices and where they lead if carried to their logical conclusion. But you know, there's a clue to Jesus' softness towards the woman in the wording. The word used for dog is kinarion, which is the diminutive noun of kion. In other words, it doesn't just mean dogs, it means little dogs, or puppies, you might say. They have the same thing in Spanish, where if you add ita to the end of a word, it means like a little version of it. I've got a Spanish friend, and she's got a little boy about the same age as Martha, and I remember meeting up with her when they were both babies. His name's Rafa, and she would call him Rafita, and Martha she would call Martita. I found it so adorable, I started calling it myself. It was a term of endearment, and this note of gentleness hidden in the insult is a clue to the woman that she's doing well. So how does the woman respond to this, the toughest test of all? With wit, with humor, with intelligence, and with the insight that the disciples lack into what the true purpose of God's chosen people is. She says, "Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the little crumbs that fall from their master's table." She picks up that diminutive and she applies it with a clever play on words. She turns around Jesus' reference to little dogs and points out that Israel's blessings will inevitably be shared. She knows Israel's vocation, even if they've forgotten it themselves. Matthew's gospel begins with Jesus' family history going back as far as who? Who can remember? Where does the genealogy at the beginning of Matthew's gospel start with? I'll give you a clue, it's not Adam. Abraham. Someone said Abraham, thank goodness. chapter 1, verse 1 said, "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Now, what was the covenant that God first made with Abraham? It comes in several stages, the promise of a son, the promise of descendants, the promise of land. But finally, in Genesis 22, after Abraham passes his test that he would not even withhold his son, God gives the full extent of his promise. And here it is. He says, "I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." Through Abraham's offspring, who will be as numerous as the grains of sand on western shore, all nations of the earth will be blessed. Well, Muddiford, really, that's sandier, isn't it? Well, that doesn't really fit with a defensive, inward-looking posture, does it? The Canaanite woman, she gets it. Israel is to be a vehicle for the blessing of the world. Do you know who else gets it? Jesus' mother, Mary. In the Song of Praise she sings when she visits Elizabeth, pregnant with Jesus, she rejoices that from now on, all generations will call her blessed. His mercy extends to who? The chosen people of Israel? No. His mercy extends to all who fear him. He will scatter who? Those wicked Gentiles? Mm-mm. He will scatter those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. He will bring down rulers and lift up who? The rightful inheritors, Israel? No, the humble. These are Abraham's true descendants, those who fear God, those who, like Mary, are humble nobodies. People like this Canaanite woman. And like Mary sees, she will be known as blessed by all generations. So through this account, this Gentile mother of a traumatized child will be known for the greatness of her faith in the person of Jesus and his compassion for a sick child. "Oh, woman," he says. That word woman is the same title of respect that he uses elsewhere for his own mother. "Great is your faith." A deadly blow to the disciples' prejudices towards women and Gentiles that was so widely held by others too. He honors her publicly, and of course he grants her request. He breaks through barriers of gender and race, and he counts this woman as a giant of faith, a true descendant of Abraham. So, following straight on from this, Jesus went to the Sea of Galilee for the second miraculous feeding that Matthew reports. So, let's play a bit of spot the difference based on the seismic implications of the story of the Canaanite woman. There are probably more than this, but I'm going to focus on three differences between the feeding of the 4,000 and the last version, the feeding of the 5,000, a couple of chapters before. Difference one, he is on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. The feeding of the 5,000 took place in a solitary place near Nazareth. So Nazareth is, you can probably see, it's way over to the west. And that's where he had been when he heard the news about John the Baptist's death. We know that he didn't go far because the people followed him on foot. The feeding of the 4,000, we learn actually from Mark's gospel, not from Matthew, took place in the Decapolis. So that is the area, those cities in red that you can see on the lower map, mainly to the east side of the Sea of Galilee and towards the south. Now, the Decapolis was a region made up of 10 or maybe more cities, mainly on the eastern side of the sea, sandwiched between the sea and the desert to the east of it. They were hotbeds of Greek culture, resplendent with marble streets, mosaic floors, running water, fountains. One of the most magnificent of these cities, called Hippos, sat on a hill on the shores of Galilee, and it was clearly visible to the fishermen of Capernaum and the other villages around the sea on the Galilean side. They were allowed to govern themselves for the most part under Rome. Clearly, they posed no political threat to the region whilst being economically vibrant. So when Jesus went to the Decapolis, he was entering Gentile-dominated territory again. Exactly the kind of cultural influence that the Pharisees and others were trying to insulate Israel against. Not Jesus. He deliberately took himself to the heart of Greek culture in the region. We don't know the makeup of the crowd that came to him to hear him, but it's not unreasonable to expect that a large proportion of them were Gentiles, given the demographics of the region. Following on from the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus literally fed the Gentiles the crumbs that fell from the children's table. He showed his disciples in the clearest term, it's time. It's time for Israel to fulfill its mission to be a blessing to all. Not just a one-off act of kindness to a desperate woman, but as its core vocation. Difference number two. In the feeding of the 5,000, we're told in general terms that Jesus had compassion on the crowd and healed their sick. In the feeding of the 4,000, Matthew is much more explicit. In verse 31, we read that the people were amazed when they saw the mute speaking, the cripple made well, the lame walking, and the blind seeing. And they praised the God of Israel. In fact, you can see that Matthew kind of repeats these things twice. He says that it happened, and then he said the people were amazed by it. He's really drilling this in, isn't he? To Jewish ears, this would have rung some massive bells, as it is a direct parallel to the prophecy in the book of Isaiah about the restoration of the people of Israel from exile. So Isaiah writes, "Then will the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf be unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy." Matthew is telling us that Jesus, as Messiah, is initiating the end of exile, the return of the Lord's favor. The kingdom of God is here. The kingdom of heaven is here, is what he's been preaching. And where is he announcing this? Not in Jerusalem, not at the temple, not even in Galilee, although he did announce it there too, as we read in Luke 4. But he's doing it in the Decapolis. Difference number three. Now, as I've said, Matthew doesn't explicitly locate this event in the Decapolis. We get that from Mark. But he gives the same message in a different way, one that would have resonated with a Jewish audience. What is distinctive to him is that it takes place up a mountain. Feeding of the 5,000, not up a mountain. Feeding of the 4,000, he goes up a mountain. This taps into a whole load of Old Testament tradition about how Jerusalem, or Zion as it was sometimes called, would one day become the great mountain to which all the nations would flock and be saved. Except here, it's Jesus that everyone flocks to, not Jerusalem, and he feeds them a feast. In other words, it's another signal that God's ancient promises are coming true. That through Jesus, the time has come when all of the nations will come to share in the blessing promised to Israel. And this mountain looks ahead to the final mountain event in Matthew's gospel, when Jesus sends his disciples out to share his message of God's forgiving love to every creature on earth. So what does all of this tell us about knowing what we're here for? Well, as Christians in the UK, a cultural minority, how do we respond? Do we withdraw from our culture like the Zealots? Like the Essenes, sorry. Do we go on the offensive like the Zealots? Do we enjoy what it has to offer uncritically like the Sadducees? Or do we guard our boundaries like the Pharisees? Jesus shows us another way. Yes, we are to be his people. But not only that, we're also given a purpose to take that blessing out. Sometimes it's easy to forget that we were those Gentile outsiders ourselves. Or perhaps some of us still question whether we really qualify to be part of Jesus' community. We might feel too much on the periphery of church, too much baggage from the past, too many failings in the present, or just not feeling like we quite look like everyone else enough to fit in. Jesus is not interested in these kind of barriers. He casually bypasses them and meets us in the present, searching our heart for hearts that are confident that his compassion is enough, that it extends to them. Great is your faith, he says. We all carry our prejudices, as Lou helpfully helped us to reflect on last week, and sometimes we need our loving teacher to point them out and to help us to move forwards. Our biases might not be about people of a different ethnic or a different migration background. They might not be based on gender. But I'm sure for all of us, there is some kind of person that could walk through those doors looking a certain way that would cause us to hesitate for a moment over our coffee, to have a moment of judgment, to throw up a barrier. If a newcomer turns up at your house group unexpectedly, what kinds of characteristics or lifestyle choices could make you feel uncomfortable? Perhaps today we could ask Jesus to find opportunities to gently reveal our hearts to us and to begin to change them. But what is the destination of that change? To become more tolerant? Nah, that's not enough, is it? That's not the example that Jesus set. To tolerate otherness from a comfortable distance. Jesus took himself and his followers right into the midst of the mainstream culture that his contemporaries had treated as a threat. That is exactly where he chose to heal the blind, the deaf, the lame, and the mute. That's where he chose to repeat his miraculous feeding of the crowd. He enacted his message of love and hope right in the midst of his culture. Our charity of this month is the Street Pastors, and that is exactly what they do. They get stuck in the messiness, and they look for the opportunities that God opens up. And we don't just want to be inclusive within our own communities. Jesus said that we're to be the salt of the earth. To do its job, we all know that salt needs to be thoroughly mixed through the food. We're not just to get our own houses in order, but to bring his message of love and welcome to the whole earth, striving for a world where no one feels the sting of exclusion that Canaanite woman did. Perhaps like me, some others here work in large institutions that run equality, diversity, and inclusion programs. Shouldn't we be the first in line to support these initiatives? To take on the role of allies with people who are marginalized? To stand up in solidarity when policies in the workplace or in government or wherever else rank people unfavorably against others? To say that there is no characteristic a person has that gives them less dignity in God's eyes or makes them less eligible to approach Jesus. Because it's exciting, isn't it, to think that we're here to be the light to the nations, that every kind of people would be restored, that we're here to be ambassadors of Jesus' kingdom and to help to reshape the world in the way he modeled for us. That in this place, at this time, he sent us as the light that darkness will not overcome. How far can Jesus' compassion extend in our culture, in our communities, in our lives? As we finish, I'd like to ask you to look again at your slips of paper that you've got, where you wrote down what we're here for at the beginning. Now, this isn't a test. You can write whatever you want. You can edit it. You can take it away and mull it over. But I'd like us to take a moment to ask Jesus to bring these things about in our lives. And if some of you are willing, I'd like to use it as a prayer together as well. So the way the prayers will go is like this. Jesus, we are here to... And then you insert your statement from your piece of paper. And then we can all respond together the words in red. Lord, give us compassion as vast as yours. I'll go first to kick us off. I think Lou said she was going to run with the mic. Is that okay, Louise? Sorry, I've forgotten that bit. Louise is going to do some running. So if anyone wants to lead us in that short prayer, Jesus, we are here to whatever you've put on your paper or whatever you feel you want to share after what we've thought about, then you can lead us in that and we'll all respond, Lord, give us compassion as vast as yours. Let's pray. Jesus, we are here to be people of the light. Lord, give us compassion as vast as yours.